From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Eric Westervelt. It's Here and Now. President Trump confirmed today that CIA Director Mike Pompeo met with Kim Jong-un in North Korea recently. The president today tweeted, "Meeting went very smoothly and a good relationship was formed. Details of summit are being worked out now. Denuclearization will be a great thing for world, but also for North Korea," end quote. CIA Director Pompeo is President Trump's choice for Secretary of State after he fired Rex Tillerson. Pompeo still needs to be confirmed. Admiral James Stavridis is dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He's also the former commander of NATO. Admiral Stavridis, welcome back.
Great to be with you, Eric.
Spy chiefs pushing diplomacy. What do you make of that?
I think it would make no sense except for the fact that Mike Pompeo has been nominated to be Secretary of State. It does make structural sense to send him over there in advance of hopefully his confirmation. To send him over there as the spy chief would have made no sense. We also ought to recognize, I think from a personality perspective, Mike Pompeo is a pretty good choice. I know him. He's high emotional intelligence. He has served in the Congress. He understands the politics of this. West Point graduate, gets the military piece of this. He's also got a nice way about him. I think he was a good choice overall, given the circumstances.
So it doesn't really matter that Mr. Pompeo is not yet Secretary of State?
I don't think so. I'm sure there will be some pushback from the Senate saying that, well, perhaps you're presuming confirmation, President Trump. And that's a legitimate question to raise. But I think overall, I think it made sense to send Mike Pompeo.
Now, this is all part of setting up a summit between President Trump and Kim. We don't yet have a time, place, or agenda for those talks. The Trump tweet today, Admiral, anyway, signals he's confident about North Korean denuclearization getting on the agenda. How confident are you that Kim might really give up his weapons program?
If I were advising Kim Jong-un, I wouldn't advise him to do so. And I think that he is very unlikely to give up his nuclear weapons as he looks at what has happened to other dictators like Muammar Gaddafi, who did so. So my guess is, let's get to the table. Let's push for the best deal we can get. But I suspect it's going to end up not with a full denuking, but rather a freezing in place of the program. Whether we can live with that or not is a subject for further discussion and conversation. But we got to start somewhere, and I think this will be at least a reasonable place to start.
Well, and can Japan live with it? The president is meeting again today with Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe in Florida. Japan's vulnerable to North Korea's short-range missiles, if not more. Talk about Japan's concerns, both security and diplomatic-wise here.
Japan has enormous appropriate security concerns as they look across the water toward North Korea. What this points us toward is moving quickly from what are, in effect, two-party talks that are unfolding, U.S., North Korea. Let's get to four-party talks. That would include South Korea and China, because in the end, we can't solve this without the Chinese. And then, to your question, Eric, we can get to six-party talks, because I think both Japan and Russia are going to have to eventually be at the table. All of this means this is going to be the work of a year or two at a minimum. So the idea that President Trump is going to go in, slap the table, and walk out with a Nobel Peace Prize, not going to happen. This is going to take some time.
Are you surprised that President Trump is looking overseas when he was really elected on a look inward, America first domestic policy agenda?
Doesn't surprise me. This has often been the case for presidents. Recall that President Bush started his presidency talking about Latin America and the importance of Mexico in our relationships. He ended up being almost entirely consumed by overseas events. I think President Trump will find that you may not be interested in the world, but the world comes after you.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in and Kim are supposed to meet next week, and an issue that might be on the table, actually ending the Korean War, because formally there was just a cessation of hostilities in 1953. What would it mean if that happens? Do you think it'd be a big deal?
I think it would be a big deal. Even through all the other negotiations we've undertaken with North Korea over the years, we never got to that. I think this would be a fairly powerful step. Now, again, I'm not euphoric about this, but I think we have perhaps a 70% chance of negotiating our way out of this. There's still a 30% chance we revert to the old model or perhaps even a 10% chance we end up in combat. So let's not count our chickens before they hatch, so to speak, but let's be hopeful about where we're headed.
Admiral James Stavridis, Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts and former NATO Supreme Allied Commander. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Eric.
The jury is in deliberations in the trial of three men, Curtis Allen, Gavin Wright, and Patrick Stein, who call themselves the Crusaders. They're accused of plotting to bomb a mosque and an apartment building where Somali immigrants live in Garden City, Kansas. The charges include conspiracy to use a weapon of mass destruction. Stephen Basaha has been covering this trial. He's a reporter at KMUW in Wichita. Stephen, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much.
The closing arguments came yesterday. What was the prosecution's main argument against these men?
So the prosecution has mostly been relying on these hundreds of hours of recordings that they had of the three men, because there was a fourth man in the room, a paid FBI informant who had like the modern equivalent of a wire. So they were able to play these recordings repeatedly throughout the trial. And during their closing arguments, the prosecution essentially gave the jury homework. They had a list of probably well over a dozen clips that they said you should go back and you should listen over these. The defense has been relying on this idea that this talk about a plot to attack a apartment complex that was predominantly Muslim immigrants, that these discussions disparaging Muslims, that this was just locker room banter. So they were disputing that by saying, like, look, actually listen to the words, listen to what they were saying. And then they also had the means, the materials, and the knowledge to do this. At one point, there was a table in front of the jury that the prosecution was just piling on with things like safety goggles, multiple copies of the anarchist cookbook, hot plates, kitchen scales, different equipment that they alleged that the defendants were using to actually make these bombs. And that went well beyond words and was becoming action.
Yeah, just to clarify, the cookbook is a recipe for making a bomb.
Yes, that's correct.
And you mentioned this fourth person who had been in the room. This is a man named Dan Day who wore a wire, and he's the reason there is any audio at all of these three people who are on trial in this case. Tell us about him and about what information he helped provide.
Yeah, so Dan Day is this paid informant, and really he is the spine of the prosecution's argument. His recordings are the spine, and also his testimony. He testified for about 5 days during this trial. We know the FBI had in fact paid him. He had received around $33,000. And we know he was a paid FBI informant before he had even met any of these defendants. And that is something that the defense has pounced on. They've essentially described him, for lack of a better term, a bounty hunter. And he was looking to essentially get these guys caught so that he could get a payday from the FBI. And the prosecution is arguing back. They described Dan Day as a hero. And they said, we wouldn't have these recordings, these words. Public safety would have been endangered without Dan Day. So how the jury views Day is going to be really essential for their verdict. And the judge did give the jury special instructions that, look, Dan Day is a paid FBI informant. You should be viewing his testimony with extra scrutiny compared to other voices you have heard throughout this trial.
So the tape that Dan Day was able to make when he wore a wire was played in court. What did you hear?
So we heard these men repeatedly say disparaging things about Muslims. We heard them refer to Muslims as cockroaches, referring to themselves as exterminators. There is one point where all three men were discussing creating a bomb and putting in things like knives, razor blades, ball bearings as a way to make them even more destructive. And while the audio was never great quality, they were playing loud music in the background as actually a way to try and mask any sort of recordings. It's still powerful to hear these words actually come from the three defendants.
One final question. These men were arrested less than 4 weeks before the presidential election in 2016. They had planned to carry out the bombing on November 9th, the day after the election. Is there any talk about whether politics and the election itself played any part in this case?
Oh, yeah, the 2016 presidential election loomed very large over this whole trial. It was actually something that the defense relied on when they were talking about this First Amendment speech of these three defendants. They said, look, all everything you've heard has to be viewed through the lens of a very divisive election where a lot of negative language was thrown around. And when you put it in that context, it's a little bit more understandable. The prosecution has pushed back against that by saying, look, they took the steps to actually start plotting, picking a target, and looking into actually making a bomb and going as far as actually making a detonator.
Thank you for telling us about the trial that you're covering. Stephen Basaha, reporter for KMUW in Wichita, Kansas, and the Kansas News Service. Stephen, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
On July 12, 2015, ultra-marathoner Scott Jurek set the speed record for the Appalachian Trail. He ran 2,189 miles from Georgia to Maine, and he did it in 46 days, 8 hours, and 7 minutes. An enthusiastic crowd of well-wishers greeted him at the top of Maine's Mount Katahdin. Scott Jurek writes about the endurance trial in the new book, North, Finding My Way While Running the Appalachian Trail. Scott Jurek, welcome to Here and Now.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
We should say that the record you set was a supported attempt at the Appalachian Trail, and your primary means of support was the person sitting next to you right now in the studio, your wife, Jenny, who also joins us. Jenny Jurek, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, Scott, you first. At the time that you decided to attempt the Appalachian Trail, you already had a lot of success, of course, as an ultra-marathoner, including 7 straight wins in the Western States 100-mile endurance run. So why look to the Appalachian Trail?
Well, I think, you know, after racing for 20 years, I still had a few things I wanted to do, but I was kind of spinning my wheels. I needed a new challenge, something to really kind of push me to those boundaries that other challenges had done in the past.
And Jenny, you didn't really like the idea of his doing the trail in the beginning, did you?
Well, it just seemed really random to me, and it seemed like something really involved that would take a lot of planning. And from the previous races I'd seen, he wasn't really into it. Like, his heart wasn't into it. So I didn't want to put all this time and effort into doing something that he wasn't going to do wholeheartedly and with that passion. But I did realize, you know, that it was a way to reignite that fire for him.
But Jenny, this way involves you because you ended up kitting out a van, the two of you did, and driving to Georgia to begin the trail. And you really have to manage. I mean, what was your job through the whole ordeal?
I mean, my main job was just to be like a roving support aid station, you know, just to provide food and water and supplies at several road crossings every day. It doesn't sound that hard, but I didn't have any cell service or GPS to really like help me with the navigation, and I had to get gas and get groceries and
do my dirty laundry.
Do his laundry, yeah.
That's just all true love right there.
Yeah, all the little daily things that needed to get done.
And Scott, meanwhile, from up atop the trail, tell us what it was like for you.
Jenny definitely had the tougher job. I just had to follow those white blazes that are iconic on the Appalachian Trail and also go up and down these mountains, you know, climbing each day. I mean, the trail climbs 500,000 feet up, 500,000 feet down over 2,200 miles. So a lot of days involve 10,000 to 13,000, 15,000 feet of climbing and 10,000 to 15,000 feet of descent. And so it definitely was challenging in its own right. Amidst that, we decided to open up the journey and let people in on it by occasionally posting on social media, but we also had a tracker and people could literally follow along wherever they were. And as we got along the trail, we had basically people showing up at trailhead, sometimes, you know, 10, sometimes 20, 30. And some were definitely a little bit, probably more overbearing on Jenny because she had to answer all their questions as they were hanging out. But they also got to join me for miles. So it really was this social. And I think that's what the Appalachian Trail, it is a social trail. It was designed to connect people as well as nature.
So people would run with you as well.
Exactly.
Did that hold you back? I mean, you were doing this to time.
It probably wasn't the best. My buddy Speed Goat, who's in the book, joined us 2 weeks in because he's like, man, you guys need help. And he was like, this is slowing you down. You got to get rid of that tracker. And for some reason, for me, I just felt like I needed that connection. And I loved hearing the stories from people, but it did get a little old to answer all their questions. And I know some people were out there like, he's answering the same questions every time somebody pulls into the next trailhead and they're joining them for the next, you know, 5 or 10 miles. But I also got a lot of inspiration from those people.
Yeah, you know, I actually heard about the fact that you were doing the Appalachian Trail from a teenager who lives nearby and who was on the trail alone and ran into you. And she was surprised that you answered her questions as well, and she was really kind of enchanted. But you have your own personal thoughts and personal trials, and I'm thinking of your mother in particular, and this is the kind of thing that you would think about when you were on the trail.
Yeah, she struggled with multiple sclerosis for over 30 years, and at a young age, I saw my mother gradually lose more and more of her physical capabilities, and she gave me perspective. It reminded me that I had two legs that maybe weren't always in the best shape and had injuries and had their own issues, but she was a reminder that, you know, I'm able to move my body, and she couldn't even do that.
When you're, trying to get from one place to the next, and you run into all sorts of obstacles, there are poisonous snakes on the route. At one point, the two of you, I think, met a bear on the trail. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
A mother bear with two cubs, which is the type of bear you don't want to run into because they're the most aggressive. We end up having to go through this, pile of rocks that rattlesnake probably infested and poison ivy all over. And Jenny is just like, I can't believe we're doing this, just so we could, tack along right along the trail, but give the mama bear enough room with her cubs.
On a day-to-day, actually minute-by-minute level, what was it like for you, Scott? These are the questions you probably are sick of answering, but I think everybody has them. I mean, how would you sleep? How would you eat? Did you ever shower over 46 days?
It really came down to, how am I going to fuel myself, take care of myself? Showers got thrown out of the window. Maybe I'd bathe in a creek, or maybe it became, basically a wet towel at the end of the night. And sometimes I just roll into bed. Sometimes I slept on the trail, on rocks, or when I would take naps for a half hour here and there. Things became more and more dire and more, primitive as we went along.
And when that happened, did you ever stop and just say, well, why am I doing this again?
Definitely. I mean, every day there were times when I'm like, why am I doing this? This is just stupid. Can I be doing this via another, means or another activity or passion? Maybe I need to find a different hobby. I'm not going to lie. There were times where I told Jenny, it seemed like it was pulling us apart rather than bringing us together.
Because you had different ideas of what you wanted to do. I mean, at that point, you were how old?
I was 41 at the time.
And that was a big factor in your decision.
Definitely. Definitely towards the end of my career, I needed something. And I also wanted to save some of these bigger challenges because I knew it would take experience, not only in sport and what I love to do, but also in life. Jenny and I had struggled with trying to raise a family, having children. And, I watched Jenny almost die in my arms on our kitchen floor a year and a half prior in it. And so it was one of these things where, life is short. And we need to do this now.
Jenny, what Scott was just referring to there was that you had, and you write about this in the book, an ectopic pregnancy. The baby was developing in your fallopian tube. At the time that Scott was running the Appalachian Trail, you had suffered from the effects of a miscarriage that you'd had earlier, but you kept that fact from him then?
I wasn't anywhere near a shower or anything that I could, or even a phone to ask my doctor what to do. So that was a little worrisome, but I wasn't about to mention it to Scott because I knew he would freak out and I knew that he would consider stopping, and we were just too close, and I just kind of risked it and hoped that everything would be okay, and it was.
I give you guys a lot of credit for the openness with which you tell your individual stories. I mean, you're such a good pair. But you talk about the friction, and like you said, you talk about the fact that it's hard to stay together with things in your life and with the things that you want to do with your life. What's worked?
I don't know. I think just that we're good communicators has been really helpful.
And understanding each other. I think that's a key part, too, is we trade off and take turns. I knew climbing Half Dome for her was a really big life goal. And so I risked some of my fears of going up slabs of rocks and heights and all these things and doing something that I wouldn't normally like to do. But for her, and I think in a partnership or in a team atmosphere, you have to be willing to not just sacrifice, but give when you need to give and then receive when you need to receive. And then, like Jenny said, it was communication and understanding. And yes, there were times that, you know, we had a couple of blowouts out on the trail, but we still came together and communicated after. And I think realized like why we were doing this instead of packing it up and going home, like we thought about doing as we were getting very close to the end.
You both also had to deal with a lot of flack that was coming in from the outside. People saying, look, you're running this beautiful trail that misses the point. How did you respond to that?
Well, I think the initial response is Jenny and I get emotional a little bit, but then I've gotten used to I'm going to have haters. 90-some percent, whether it's 99 or 98% of the people out there. In fact, all the thru-hikers that I would spend time with, they loved the fact of what I was doing and they understood like we got the thru-hiking experience and we did really enjoy it. I wasn't moving much faster than most thru-hikers. I just spent more time on the trail each day. There were days that I didn't stop moving.
In the end, you beat the old record, Scott, by 3 hours, 13 minutes. You didn't hold the record for long, though. Is that okay?
Oh, it's definitely okay. And I don't think it's a major spoiler because a lot of people could look this up. But I went back and helped my buddy Speed Goat, and I watched him break my record those last 10 days. And I think that's what the sport is all about. I think that's what life is about. You should help even, you know, somebody who's your competitor, maybe friend, raise the bar, do something that they didn't think they could do. And that's what I love about it. And since then, it's been broken again. So it's almost like the record's only stood for a year now each time. It wasn't so much about the record. The record was the tool to push me that next level that I needed to push myself to really see if I could get every ounce of effort out of my body, mind, and soul. It was really this all-encompassing. It was like living, I guess, multiple lifetimes. If I were to sum it up, it was like, you know, life experiences that you could only have by pushing yourself that far.
Scott and Jenny Jurek, their book is called North, Finding My Way While Running the Appalachian Trail. So nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
The U.S. Supreme Court is hearing arguments today in a case about fishing rights in Washington state. 21 tribes say hundreds of pipes are blocking salmon from spawning grounds, but the state says fixing the problem would be too expensive. As Eilish O'Neill reports from member station KUOW in Seattle, the outcome of the case could affect tribes and landowners across the West and the Midwest.
Brian Cladisby and his fellow fishermen are standing on the dock of a channel that empties into Puget Sound. They're talking about getting their boats ready in time for summer salmon runs.
And what's that? Joe told me about a different kind of decking. What's it called?
Cladisby is the chairman of the Swinomish tribe. He says those runs aren't what they used to be.
A lot of the fishermen, Indian and non-Indian, are stuck on the banks now.
That has to do with a whole host of problems. Climate change, hydroelectric dams, overfishing, pollution, and culverts. Those are the pipes that carry streams under roads. If they're designed poorly, they can keep salmon from swimming upstream to spawn. Steve Hinton's a biologist for Cladisby's tribe. Today, he's giving me a tour of salmon-blocking culverts on the Skagit River system in northwest Washington. The culvert we're looking at right now is bad. Fish would have to leap 2 feet up a waterfall to get into the broken pipe.
Just keep throwing yourself at it, I guess, you know. And it is a pretty ragged edge for them to hit. What we're looking at is a lip of concrete that looks like a broken knife's edge. It's very sharp and jagged.
Fixing this culvert would require digging up the road and putting in a bridge.
It's a biggie. This is going to be a $3-4 million project at the very least.
Washington State has more than 800 culverts that keep salmon from reaching more than 1,000 miles of streams. The state estimates fixing the problem could cost more than $2 billion. Washington's Attorney General, Bob Ferguson, declined to comment. But a statement on his website says he appealed this case all the way to the Supreme Court, quote, on behalf of the taxpayers of Washington State, end quote. So far, all the lower courts have ruled in favor of the tribes. Robert Anderson teaches tribal law at the University of Washington. He says the case hinges on an 1855 treaty between the federal government and the tribes of the Puget Sound region.
The tribes agreed to sell their land to the United States in exchange for reserving the right to fish at usual and accustomed stations.
The question now is whether that right to fish means the right to put a net in the water or the right for there to be fish to catch. Tribes in six other Pacific Northwest and Midwest states have similar treaties with the federal government, and farmers and ranchers there are worried. Sam Kaiser is a fifth-generation rancher in Clealum, Washington, just east of the Cascade Mountains. He fears that if the Supreme Court decides in favor of the tribes, he might eventually have to take costly steps, like building thousands of dollars of fences to keep cattle away from salmon-bearing streams.
I would be afraid that they're going to make the cost and aggravation of making a living on the land just too hard and cumbersome.
Back on the Swinomish Reservation, Cladisby says he hopes the outcome of the case will benefit more than just salmon.
If we win, this will have a positive impact for the tribes whose environment has been degraded or impaired over the last 100 to 150 years.
Whatever the Supreme Court decides could change a lot about how land and water are managed in a large swath of the U.S. For NPR News, I'm Alicia Neal.
There's been a series of angry protests at the State University of New York, Plattsburgh this semester. The campus is near the Canadian border in a rural area where students of color say they often feel unwelcome, even threatened. One catalyst for their concern was a racist Snapchat message that was sent by a freshman at the school who was from the nearby town of Keene Valley. But even some critics of the students say the message was an ill-conceived joke. Zach Hirsch from North Country Public Radio reports.
Maria Gates sits on the sofa at a friend's house in Keene Valley with her hands in her lap, holding her cell phone. The 18-year-old started at SUNY Plattsburgh last fall and says the friends she made on campus liked to make a lot of crude jokes.
Hanging around with them, everybody in that chat always made racist jokes, fat jokes, just things that people see on the internet now all the time these days.
They shared the jokes in a private group on Snapchat, the social media platform, as part of a game.
If you've ever heard of Cards Against Humanity, it's like this game where you choose answers, and a lot, it's supposed to be messed up humor.
It grew into a contest to see who could say the most shocking thing. Gates says some of her friends started using the N-word, and then came the idea of lynching African Americans.
And like it got a laugh out of everybody. I just thought like everybody always found it funny, so I wanted to be a part of that.
Gates sent her own message, a selfie with the caption, "Lynching Black People Tonight," except she used the N-word. One of the students in her Snapchat group had had enough. She captured the image and shared it on campus. A couple of weeks later, on Valentine's Day, Gates was in statistics class when her phone lit up.
And it started, like, spreading wildfire. And that's when, like, everything started to blow up. And then the cops showed up at my door with the photo in their hand, and I knew it was just going to be bad.
A lot of people said they thought Gates and her boyfriend, who's also in the photo, were making an actual threat. There were packed campus meetings and marches.
Enough!
Enough!
Is enough!
Enough!
Is enough!
At one of the meetings, a screenshot of Gates' message was projected onto a big screen. People were furious. That's faculty member Danae Robertson, who's also a former SUNY Plattsburgh student. Robertson is Black. She says the Snapchat message Gates sent fits a frightening pattern.
Neo-Nazi posters on campus, neo-Nazi posters in the community, faculty and staff members being outwardly sexist and homophobic, transphobic in class.
Suddenly, Maria Gates was seen as a symbol of racism and intolerance on a campus where people of color already felt under attack. She says at first she thought maybe she could walk it back, say sorry, and everything might turn out okay.
I was talking to my friend about it, and I was like, do you think I have a chance? I feel so bad. Like, I've tried to apologize. Like, what, do you know if I can do anything?
Gates says she soon realized it was too late. She had to leave. Had to go home to Keene. But Gates found the controversy had followed her. people in Keene, a tiny mountain village about an hour's drive from Plattsburgh, learned about the racist Snapchat, and there was a ton of anger. Soon came a series of town meetings led by local resident Jane Hawk.
So we're going to have feeling words, and we're going to have issues, and we're going to have goals at the end of it.
About 40 people came out on this Monday night. They wore name tags, drank apple cider, and sat in a circle. Sherry Warner's son is one of the few African-American students at Keene Central School. She told the group she was outraged by Gates' message. She said it added to a climate of fear for her son.
I'm desperate for solutions right now. I don't even want to send him to college in this country. He doesn't want to get a license because he doesn't want to get pulled over. It's sickening. Totally sickening.
A high school senior in Keene named Corianne Stoner also became part of the conversation. She's African-American, and she wrote a long public letter saying the problem isn't just Gates. It's the wider culture of people growing up here.
A kid walked behind me, actually a very close friend of mine, and he would just, like, jokingly walk behind me and pretend to, like, crack a whip and stuff and, like, yell, yeah, yeah, and stuff like that. Constant jokes about the absence of a father, and that's just expected of a black kid.
But in her letter and in public meetings since, Stoner actually defended Maria Gates. She says Gates is one of her best friends. Stoner says a problem is young people like Gates clumsily trying to adopt parts of black culture, trying to be cool.
Like a kid will walk up to me and they'll be like, what's up, mate? You know, and they'll say the N-word. And I either have that choice to, in front of their friends, humiliate them and like call them out on it. Or if I go along with it and kind of be like, oh, like, what's up, right back at them, like, they'll be the coolest kid in school. And so it's a weird dynamic.
Maria Gates says she left her small town for college thinking this kind of exchange was acceptable, something white kids could get away with if their hearts were in the right place.
I was convinced that these things are okay to say if you mean them in a joking manner. But I've learned my lessons that this is not okay. And I'm really sorry. I made a really dumb and stupid mistake. Like, I take 100% responsibility for that.
I play that clip of tape of her apologizing for SUNY Plattsburgh faculty member Danae Robertson. She lets out a deep sigh.
I mean, her taking accountability is great. So I'm sure a lot of people will appreciate that. But what she did was wrong and borderline unforgivable.
Robertson says for Maria Gates to help make this right, she needs to go beyond apology to some kind of action.
And I hope that she takes this lesson and educates herself and her community around racism and systemic oppression and works to help fight it. Because now that's essentially her duty. She put herself in this position, and that's what she owes to us.
Meetings continue in Keene Valley. The next one is set for this week. Corianne Stoner and Sherry Warner's son, Miles, say they'll give a talk on their experiences as students of color called Even in Keene. And discussions continue at SUNY Plattsburgh, where students of color are pushing campus officials to do more to help them feel safe. For Here and Now, I'm Zach Hirsch.
Well, the Boston Red Sox and the Los Angeles Angels face off again tonight in Anaheim, California. During last night's matchup, all eyes were on rookie pitching sensation Shohei Ohtani. He won his first two starts, and he's batting .367 with three home runs. He can hit as well. Some baseball writers have called the rookie the Japanese Babe Ruth. Ohtani is a rare double threat, and baseball seems hungry for a story like this. And so we're going to add to the hype. We're turning to A. Martinez, host of Take Two on KPCC in Southern California. A., welcome.
Hi, Eric.
Hey, occasionally pitchers get clutch hits or smack a home run, but it's pretty rare to see a player like Ohtani who's so good on the mound and at the plate. What are his strong points?
Well, he can throw a baseball 100 miles an hour, and then he can hit a baseball about 450 feet. So starting there, Eric, you have the building blocks for what could be what people are describing him and calling him the millennial Babe Ruth. He's millennial age, but he does things that Babe Ruth did about 100 years ago.
Babe could hit, and he was a pitcher for a brief time. Yeah. Tell me, in Southern California, are fans pretty excited about all this?
Oh, yeah. I remember back when I was a kid, Fernando Valenzuela, the Mexican young left-hander in the early 80s, he caused a sensation when he started winning games. And then Hideo Nomo, who was from Japan as well, later in the 90s, also caused a stir. That is happening right here with Shohei Ohtani. He's bringing out fans, Japanese fans. It is just quite the scene when he pitches. They're making so much noise that in some cases they're asking fans to quiet down a bit because it's just too much noise.
But Ohtani got smacked with a dose of reality last night against the Red Sox. The Sox are off to a great start at 14-2. Let's take a listen to this clip from the New England Sports Network.
High fly ball, well hit, deep left, back, 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 gone! Shohei Ohtani, say hello to Mookie Betts.
Hey, tell us about last night.
Well, we were waiting to see Shohei Ohtani against a good lineup. He had faced the Oakland A's in his first two starts, and they strike out a lot. They're a young team. They're not very good. And he racked up 18 strikeouts in those two games. So against the Red Sox, we were waiting to see, okay, that's a good lineup. And it turns out that a better lineup didn't match well with what Ohtani was about to expect. And he also developed a blister on his finger, which caused his outing to be cut short to only two innings. So I wouldn't glean too much from this, but he does eventually need to bounce back and show that he can handle a better lineup.
Don't read too much into one start, and the blister's not that big a deal, eh?
Well, it could be. That's the thing. The way he pitches, it aggravates that part of the finger where he got the blister, so that thing can linger, but it's not going to affect his ability to hit, so he should be in the lineup later in the week trying to hit those long home runs that he's hit so far this season.
He doesn't bat that much. Do you think the Angels might change strategy with him hitting the ball so well, or is that kind of risky?
The strategy with him so far is that he does not hit on the days before or after he pitches. But now that he's got this blister injury, they might be able to get him in the lineup a little bit more and wait for this thing to heal before he gets back on the mound.
We'll be watching, as will the baseball world. A. Martinez, host of KPCC's Take Two. Thank you.
Thanks, Eric.
All right, if you've bothered watching the fake news media in the past 24 hours, which I do not recommend, you may have noticed they have a new obsession and a new target to feign their moral outrage at, and they have decided to hyperventilate and go wall to wall with hysterical coverage about me.
That's Fox News host Sean Hannity last night defending himself after it was revealed that Hannity was named as a client of President Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen. Fox News released a statement yesterday saying Hannity continues to have the company's full support. Meantime, additional reporting links the Fox News anchor with other Trump-connected attorneys. NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik joins us now from New York. Hi, David.
Mr. Westervelt.
Good to talk to you. Fox News acknowledged that its executives were caught a bit by surprise, but the network is still backing Hannity. He gets a pass. I mean, how big of a deal is this?
It's a totally a fair question. You know, people will say, Sean Hannity will say, hey, people know what they're getting with me. But what we didn't know was that, in the week in which he was battering Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller for looking into not only the president and various issues around him, but the president's lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, that when Sean Hannity was accusing the special prosecutor of running rampant over the right attorney-client privilege that Michael Cohen might have with his clients, that in at least Cohen's eyes, that Sean Hannity was one of them, and that they clearly had ties and a connection behind the scenes, however you want to characterize that relationship, that the public didn't know about and therefore couldn't evaluate his commentary on.
I mean, Hannity says, you know what you're getting with me, but, you know, our commentator's saying, look, these are ethical red lines, you know, and not disclosing these connections.
I think for anyone who is a journalist or even works for an institution with journalistic aspirations, as Fox News repeatedly asserts that it is, and a place that does indeed have real reporters who work there, any place has to have disclosures, has to have transparency. It is fine to have point of view. Totally fine. You should know where people are coming from. It is okay to have certain kinds of entanglements, but they have to be entanglements you can live with in public and have them disclosed. According to what Michael Cohen's lawyer said, before a federal judge, Kimba Wood, the client had, beseeched Cohen to keep those things confidential. Sean Hannity in his own radio show on Monday said every time that he asked Michael Cohen for advice in an informal way, he would say, he assumed that it was covered by attorney-client privilege. And indeed, he would say out loud, attorney-client, and that Cohen would say attorney-client. And the two of them would say, good, we got it, go. And he would ask the question. Sean Hannity then said that, of course, isn't really an attorney-client relationship. He invoked the very words it's hard to you know, purge those from one's mind when thinking about it now.
I mean, it looks like he's trying to have it both ways. And The Atlantic reports that Hannity also had ties to other attorneys connected to the president. What do we know about those other lawyers and their connections to Hannity?
Well, particularly take Jay Sokolow, who's a lawyer who's been very involved in conservative circles in recent years. He has been one of the few lawyers who has stood by the president in all these things. A number of very prominent lawyers have refused to come on board, perhaps concerned about the president's legal situation, perhaps concerned about his record of not paying people he hires in the past. But Sokolow represented Hannity in a grievance he had with, I believe, a radio station in which he was asking them to cease certain characterizations and use of things he had done on the air and commenting about him. So there's an instance in which Sokolow had been on the air. I had not seen any instance in which Hannity had labeled him as somebody who had represented him. But according to the reporter for The Atlantic who first divulged that relationship, she said, in fact, there was at least one time in the numerous appearances that Sokolow made on Hannity's show that he did do so. There was at least shows you that Hannity has the ability to register that such things are worth disclosing and to do so on the air.
Interesting. I mean, David, Hannity has certainly pushed boundaries before. In 2010, Fox News, you know, yanked him from appearing at a Tea Party rally. In 2016, he was put into a Trump TV ad. But he's now, as I understand it, Fox's top-rated host, millions of viewers a night. I mean, is he sort of too big to discipline in Fox's eyes in some respects?
I think that it seems to be somewhat beyond sanction at the moment. That under Rupert Murdoch, since the dismissal of the late Roger Ailes as chairman of Fox News, ultimately Rupert decided that he needed to back the Trump presidency all the way. Sean Hannity is the president's biggest supporter on TV and, let's be honest, off it. He's been described as being a member of an informal kitchen cabinet. On the phone all the time. Trump calls him. He calls the president. He offers advice on the air and, you know, and by phone and sometimes in person. You know, there's no degrees of separation between the interests of the Trump presidency and the rhetoric that you see on the air pretty much 110% of the time on the Sean Hannity's show on Fox. And this has served well in a certain core group of Trump supporters and a certain core group of Fox News viewers. I can tell you there are journalists at Fox who are just appalled by this. It is not the first time that he's appalled journalists there. You know, Fox News retracted a story about that seemingly validated without any factual basis a conspiracy theory involving the death of a Democratic National Committee young staffer. Sean Hannity had been pumping that for months. He never apologized to the family. He never even took back the story. You know, people there wonder, is there any, you know, journalistic tenet that he will be held to given his popularity with Fox's base?
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thanks a lot.
You bet.
Here and Now is a production of NPR News and WBUR in Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Eric Westervelt.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.